Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig, and I just wanted to give you an update. Over the last 9 months, in large part because of your listener support, we've managed to build this show into one of the top guitar and human interest podcasts online. As a result, we now have openings for a select group of businesses to advertise on and sponsor this show. And I thought you, as a listener, would be in the best position to make recommendations to business owner friends of yours who might benefit from advertising here on the Everyone Loves Guitar Show. So if you know a business owner who might profit from advertising on this show, have them connect with me by going to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertising. Again, that's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertising. I'd love to have a brief conversation with them to see how we might be able to help. Thanks for your help. And now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. We've got a really cool and super popular guitar player with us today, with the one and only Zane Carney. Zane is a singer-songwriter, Grammy-nominated guitarist. He's most known for his work with John Mayer, Avril Lavigne, Broadway Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, and his own LA-based rock band, Carney. And he's also got a ton of projects upcoming that we'll talk about. He's worked with Bono and Edge, David Foster, Justin Timberlake, and Don Was. And he's also shared the stage with Keith Urban, Steven Tyler, Jackson Brown, Nicole Scherzinger, and Stevie Wonder, and loads of other folks. In 2013, John Mayer handpicked Zane without an audition to play guitar in his touring band and on his album Paradise Valley. While he was in Brazil for Rock in Rio, Zane released his debut EP, Confluence, and he discovered a worldwide audience for his own solo music. And as of today, Zane's headline shows in Japan, Australia, Korea, Mexico, most of Europe, and of course, his hometowns of New York City and LA, where he plays to sold-out theaters without the aid of a label. He co-wrote multiple songs with Avril Lavigne for her upcoming 2018 release, and he also opened for and he's playing in Johnny Lang's band in Europe, U.S., and Canada, and he's coming up with a pretty big tour in that. And he also has a summer residency at the L.A. famous Troubadour Club, and we'll talk about this today. Hey, man, thank you so much. I know you're so busy. I appreciate your time.
Oh, man, my pleasure, Craig. That was, man, my management wrote a bio that actually makes me sound cool. Thanks, man.
Hey, so what were you doing right before you landed the gig with John, and how did that whole opportunity come up?
Mainly ketamine and ayahuasca. No, I'm kidding.
Hey, whatever it takes.
No, I don't do drugs. I was doing that Spider-Man show on Broadway. I had a band called Carney with my brother Reeve, and we had basically just broken up in 2012. And I was kind of playing Spider-Man and not wandering, but sort of wondering what I was going to do next. And then John called me in March, February, or something like that, 2013. So, yeah, just mainly doing that Broadway show.
It's like, how did he call? What was the.
Man, it was so random. I used to be a child actor as well. I was on a sitcom as a kid. And
what sitcom?
Yeah. I was on a show called Dave's World.
There you go.
Yes, yeah. So that was like most of my childhood. And in fact, the director on Dave's World and the star of it, Harry Anderson, who unfortunately just passed away 2 months ago, but they were really encouraging about my music. And I always thought I'd be an actor. And they were like, no, you really should do this guitar thing. I was like, really?
That's so cool.
It's so random. So long story short, I was auditioning for pilot season in New York City because I was kind of aimless in 2012. Like Carney broke up. What the heck am I doing? So I went back to acting, and these pilot people, they auditioned for pilots. They're like, oh, we're going to get you a pilot, you know, sort of these gatekeepers at CW. And literally I walked out of an audition at CW thinking like, wow, I'm going to get a pilot and go back into acting, you know, screw the music industry or whatever. And then I got an email the next morning saying, hey, this is John Mayer's tour manager. I want you to talk to me about work. And within about a week, I was hired to play with him. And then about 3 weeks later, flew out to play Ellen with him. And during the rehearsal for Ellen, I played something like Olivia. And John, right after we played it the first time, was like, okay, phew. Okay, this is going to work. Because I had an audition, you know? So I was like, okay, cool. Oh, God.
But like, where did he find you from? I mean,
he found me through the same person, I think, that connected you and me, which is James Valentine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So James used to come to these jam nights in LA at either Teddy's or Guy's, and they were run by this actor and DJ Danny Masterson. Some people might know him from like That 70s Show. But so he did these jazz nights, and he'd have a live band play, and I was the guitar player in those. And James Valentine and Adam Levine would come by a lot, And James and I became super nerdy jazz guitar buddies.
Right, right.
So when I got the call,
wild.
John, I was like, what? Who gave you my number? I was like, oh, James.
Jeez. That is so wild, man.
Yeah, it's crazy.
James is like the quiet, unassuming guy, like, you know, making all these, connections in the background, man.
If I ever like have a like a hit song or something, I'm gonna buy him a Ferrari or whatever car he likes. Because pretty much playing with John changed the trajectory, you know, for so many reasons for me. So I'm so grateful about that.
In what way?
You know, it was I kind of went from playing in Kearney, which was a really that was an incredible thing because our band was sort of like Zeppelin meets the Beatles meets Jack White meets Radiohead. It was very guitar driven, you know, and orchestration driven on the guitar tip, and lead guitar driven. So I got to really sort of become who I am because of that band.
Sure.
But we, even though we were signed to Interscope, I'm like, we opened for you too. And Bono said some really nice stuff about all of us in the band. Like, and like my management quoted all these nice things that he said and all that jazz. Even though that had happened, we were still relatively unknown. And then we broke up. So for me, it was more like I knew what I loved to do, and people like Bob Lefsetz or Jimmy Iovine, or they had heard me and they knew about me. I didn't have like a global platform yet because Kearney was basically this rock band that the head of our label loved, you know, Jimmy Iovine at the time. Yeah. But like it was hard to market us. We didn't have like 2 minute radio songs, 2.5 minute radio songs. And so when John hired me, it was like, oh, now everyone knows about me. This is awesome. So that's kind of how it changed things for me.
So it's opened a lot of doors for you, made your name more of a, made you more of a commodity than an obscurity.
Yeah. And I say like, you know, I could have said before, or not I, my management had written before like, oh, Bono said this thing about his guitar playing and he's worked on whatever. But like, that was more for a bio. Whereas now I don't need a bio anymore. Like people are like, oh, you're that guy from John Mayer's band. Yeah. What's up? Like people who are not guitar nerds, who are not industry nerds, just music fans.
Yeah, yeah.
At least half my audience, I'd say, when I'm playing Tokyo or I'm playing Kentucky, or they're usually like, I'd say half of them are like, oh, I'm your fan now. I bought your CDs. I bought your T-shirts. I'm on your email list. But I found out about you because of John Mayer. That's how I found out about you.
So can you be good with that and like just say, hey, I'm content with that? Because some people, I think, struggle with like, oh, I haven't suffered enough kind of a mentality. I get that a lot. And even though they've suffered a lot, it's almost like, you know.
And the good news is I would say, and I think my closest friends would agree, like I am equal parts extremely grateful just that I, for some reason, have been dropped this willingness to practice and this ability to like understand the fretboard and all that stuff. But at the same time, I've gone through a lot. I mean, most people think I'm like 24 or something. I mean, even John, when he hired me, he was like, oh, he's like 22. I'm like, well, I'm definitely 28, but thank you. So right now I'm 33. And so I still, people like, I think, lucky you. And I am so lucky because I have that gratitude.
Yeah.
But, it's been a crazy journey, and it's been especially frustrating because I think for my brother and me, if we would have come up in the 60s or 70s, it would have been a no brainer, like, you know, the sort of music we make and like to make is, it's more about, lyrically about, you know, personal truths or spiritual truths or sort of toxic experiences or struggles. It's a little less what's currently in the mainstream music market, which is either pill taking or like how to get high and let go of your problems for the night, because that's what you do when you're oppressed emotionally and financially and you just try to live for the night because it's so stressful. And we don't write music like that. And so,
yeah.
And I like to write songs that actually tell a story. So for me, that sometimes takes a little more than 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so because of that, it's been a really tough journey. I mean, it's been a beautiful journey, but you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had someone come up to me in New York or LA and be like, why aren't there 5,000 people here? And I say, well, you know, I'm not on the radio yet. You know, I don't really write those sort of songs. I hope that one day the radio format changes a little and these songs do come out. But yeah, and also it's not like it's just the system. I'm new to songwriting as of the past 7 or 8 years. So, but yeah, there are times where I'll show up in Tokyo and it's a sold out show and I'm like, whoa, this is awesome. And then I'll play in Kentucky and I'm like, why are there 8 people? Like, what the heck? You know? So the journey for me, when I get a break, like playing with John, it feels like, because of all the hours and hours I put into practicing the guitar and understanding music theory and loving that process, it feels like a nice balance versus a lot of these young pop stars that are 17 that just become pop stars. So I definitely feel like the journey feels sort of equal right now.
Good. It's good that you could allow yourself to appreciate that because there's no reason not to.
Yeah, it's awesome. And also people get found out from being on Kiss Radio or they found out from being on Z100. People find out about me from John Mayer. I'll take whatever it is because to me, I'd rather be discovered by being attached to someone and then people discover my passion for the art than to be kind of a phony, which I think – not that I'm saying anyone is a phony, but there are a lot of young kids who come up and all they really want is respect. But because the reason they came up was with pop music and they don't really have skills on their instruments, it's they have this lifelong thing of feeling like a phony, whereas I've had 15 years of kind of grinding and grinding and then a John Mayer thing happens. It's like, wow, this is awesome. I don't feel scared if people find fine-tooth comb my playing because I had 15 years of just shedding and trying and struggling and trying to make it. And so it's really an incredible breath of fresh air when the John thing happens. It's awesome.
It's good, man. I'm glad you feel that way.
Yeah.
What did you learn most from your experience working with John?
I learned a lot. Geez. Well, first off, I had been playing Spider-Man for 2 years straight. And that's a Broadway show. And so it's the same show. And so my guitar playing was a teeny bit rusty when I started with them again because I was either writing songs at home or just playing that same show. So when I came into the first rehearsal, I was like, damn, people weren't lying. This dude can play. Crap, I should have practiced more. So that was really fun to be like, wow, he just really – it is possible to strive to do it all, to really write, really sing, really play. But I also – he was so, we're still friends now. He's just so supportive of my instincts. And so that helped me trust my instincts even more. What else? I learned about just incredible songwriting. I'm still trying to find that balance because I'm very much of a feeler when I write and he's so good at the mathematical precision of a song. But his songs have so much emotion. So I'm trying to continue to develop that after seeing it firsthand from him. It's okay to kind of puzzle stuff together songwriting wise, while still having it be full of heart. So I'm trying to still grow from that. I don't know. There are other things that I kind of feel like I learned before John, like opening for U2 or opening for Government Mule or playing different festivals. I used to play with Jesse McCartney and all these people. Playing big,
Talk about that opening for U2 and opening for Mule because I love Mule. Warren's one of my favorites.
Oh, the best. Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, I was 20 or 21 when Carney did that. And he brought Reeve and me up to play on Radiohead's Creep and he gave me the big solo.
Oh my God, he does such a good version of that. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, but he knew I love guys like that, blues guys of that, the Buddy guys and guys like that, that see young kids and see what they're really doing and support them. It's so special. I mean, he gave me a 4-minute solo at the end to just rip. This was in probably Fresno or something. We were just opening for them at some theater. But he's very supportive. And again, you said, what are some of the good takeaways from playing with John? When someone introduces me now, I never bring it up, but when they say, hey, Zane played with John Mayer, and no matter who you are, they'll be like, oh, come sit in on my set.
There's no fear.
They know I've been vouched for.
Yeah.
And so I've talked, when I give clinics and master classes at universities, I give master classes on classical and jazz theory, kind of a la Jacob Collier. You know how he does it, if you're familiar with his work. But a lot of kids ask well, this is dumb. All we care about is the music, not networking. And I'm like, hold on.
Let me tell you a little story about before John and after John.
Yeah. And not that, once people heard me play, thankfully they were always generous and kind and supportive. Not that I'm the best or anything, but they were just nice.
No, but you at least, it's not like you got a layup thrown to you. It's like you earned,
right.
It's not like you got that position. And you didn't deserve it technically or playing wise,
That's my hope happened. I mean, I still have tons of, idols in my mind and people I look up to, but not one of them at this point would I feel nervous playing with. Not because I'm so good, but at all, but purely because I love the language of music so much. Yeah. And so if they go into a conversation in some different mode or in some different world music style or in some different keys and sure, I just feel like it'll be fun. And so it's really nice when John calls. Now I'm like, oh, if Paul McCartney's like, let's go play, I'd be like, great, I can't wait. I wouldn't be like, oh, but what if I don't know this style? I'd be like, oh, I've been spending so many years practicing it because I love the instrument. Like, this is going to be fun. I can't wait. So it's really cool, man. Yeah.
That's awesome. And for the record, you do not look 33. You look like, you know, 25.
I haven't shaved today. Thanks, man.
talk about how you got the gig and the nature of the engagement with some of these guys and what you were doing. If you have a cool or interesting story about working with them.
Yeah.
Justin Timberlake.
That was fun. Yeah. So my my former manager was a guy named David Sonnenberg. Mm-hmm. And I became managed by him purely through Carney. And so the real quick synopsis here is that the Revolving Band was a band my brother had. It was called Reeve Carney, the Revolving Band. It included Charles Jones on keys. Some of the listeners might know him from Wolfpack.
I interviewed Corey.
Yeah, great. And Charles also is Andrew Day's MD, and he plays with Raphael Sadiq, and he's just one of the best organ players and singers in the world. So he was in the band. My sister Paris Carney was in the band. She's toured the world a couple times over with the Jonas Brothers, singing backgrounds with them, and she writes songs for different artists, like top lines and this stuff. Tommy King was in it for a hot second, which we'll talk about him later. But and I have a new project, but he is Haim's MD. So it's all these crazy people that would kind of revolve through the band, but Reeve, my sister, and myself were the constants. And then that band became Carney once Interscope signed us. And so once it became Carney, Interscope said, we're going to sign Zane. He's like, he's the Keith Richards to Reeves Mick Jagger. So suddenly I'm signed to a major label with my brother. Then Sonnenberg said, well, we're going to manage you. So I kind of fell into management. And at this time I was not an artist. I was just discovering that I was really a lead guitar player, you know, outside of just like quote unquote solos. Sure. I was like, I love like Johnny Greenwood. I love him. I love really kind of songs. So my management, I guess, the day to day that we had, Ken Komisar, he was the president of Justin Timberlake's label, Tenman Records. Justin had this new artist, Matt Morris, that was on the friggin' Mickey Mouse Club with him when he was a kid. He needed a guitar player. Matt Morris had come to all the Carney gigs. We had a lot of industry fans more than popular fans. And so Matt's like, I want Zane to play guitar and I want Carney to play it. So we came in, and when I walked in, I didn't even know Justin was producing it, I don't think. I walked in, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. What's up, man? He's like, yo, man, here's the track. Listen to it. And we played it once. He's like, cool. Can you go do some stuff? And so we just walked in and played after hearing it. And then at the end, he's like, yo, man, I want you to improvise at the end of this song. Just like do chord melody improvisation. I'm like, okay. So I did a few takes. He's like, do it again. Did it again. He's like, do it like three more times. I'm like, all right. So I just did, you know, random improvisations every time. And I have my guitar right over there. I could almost play what it was. Then at the end, he's like, yeah, man, go take a break. So I go get some coffee or something. And I come back and he's like, check this out. And the end of the song was just like seven of my guitars playing in tandem, you know? So, cause they were all like diatonic, you know, with the harmony. Very so cool. All together. And I was like, oh dude, I'm going to steal that technique. I'm going to start doing that on my records. But, he was really generous and really kind. And then he called me for another session about 2 months later, but I was on tour with Carney and now my friend plays trumpet in his touring band. So yeah, some fun connections there.
That's cool. It's amazing how like incestuous the music business is, man, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what a small, like little guitar world it kind of is.
Totally, man. It's a small, I would almost say for me too, because it is a small guitar world, but it's also a small stylistic world. Like once you're in with, you know, a pop thing, then suddenly someone like Avril Lavigne will be like, oh, I want to work with you. You know, or if you're in with the jazz scene and you have a record you're on, then all the jazz guys will say, cool. And it's that thing kind of with the John Mayer effect.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't even consider it a John Mayer effect. I almost say it's more like if I talk to someone on the street randomly and say, hey, would you like to be my friend? Most people will be skeptical. But if I introduce them by saying myself by saying, hey, I know your brother-in-law. You play on the same hockey team that I play on. My name's Zane. You've probably heard about me. They'll go, oh yeah, okay, I'd like to be your friend.
Yeah.
Assault someone with information, they're going to be closed off. So if I say I'm a guitar player, it's like, okay, what does that mean? But if I say, oh, well, you know, I toured with John Mayer. Oh, okay, well, let's play. So I think it's human nature to be discerning until someone's vouched for you.
I think you just came up with the title of your first book, The John Mayer Effect, man.
I like that.
I'm totally serious, man. I love that. That'll sell.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're probably right. I feel so bad, though, because he's my friend. So I don't know if I'd do that to him using his name as a promotional tactic. But I love the title.
Yeah, it's a psychological dynamic of, you know, interpersonal relationships.
A
study by Zane Carney.
That's hilarious. I love it. I love it.
Don was. Talk about a great, you know, successful producer and just musician. How did that come about?
Yeah. That was through John Mayer. So that was and it's funny, a lot of the stuff is top loaded with John Mayer stuff, but there were only three or four real personal relationships that were developed from John. Most of them were from Carney. But yeah, Dom was producing Paradise Valley, and I had this special signature guitar I had, the Zane Carney signature Jazzica thing through Hofner, and I was playing it. So before it became my signature guitar, I'm in the studio, and he walked in the room. He's like, what is that guitar? I'm like, oh, it's this random one-off that like no one has because I Frankenstein it. He's like, No, not the guitar. What's the song you're playing? I'm like, oh, is this like this original that I wrote? He's like, we got to talk about that later. And so later on this year, he doesn't know this yet, but I'm going to reach out to him and send him this jazz record that I just recorded in LA. But this is an interesting thing to talk about too, real quickly. Like, management is a tough issue because David Sonnenberg was managing me at the time. And I told him I had this jazz record done. It's called Amalgam. Came out, been released already. And it's an instrumental guitar record. And I was like, dude, Dom Was would get this record. We should talk to Blue Note. They should release this. He's like, sure, baby, we'll do it. And like nothing ever happened.
Is that how he really talks? Sure, baby, we'll do it.
He was a New Yorker. I'll tell you. He's a great man. I just think our working relationship doesn't make sense. But he's amazing. But so, yeah, then Dom came in literally 2 years later on a John Mayer session and asked me about that song that I told my manager to send him 2 years earlier. So again, this John Mayer process did help me to trust my instincts. I'm like, I knew Don would have gotten this. Like, I tried to. I just wasn't known enough at that time in 2010 or 11 to get in touch with Don. But now I can email him, and just say, hey, Don, you want to check this record out?
Shows like the universe, how, when stuff's meant to be, it's going to happen in spite of.
Totally. And I would go, for me, this is why that my songs are about what they're about. I would go even one layer deeper, which is that part of why that connection happened wasn't just because I knew Don and I were meant to be, but because the anger and bitterness that came up when I was like, God dang it, I knew he was going to like this song. I'm so angry about my past and I'm resentful towards it. Okay, now I can address that.
It would not
have come up if that process wouldn't have happened that way.
Sure.
It would have been handed to me. And I like to believe that because I care so much about other people's hearts and I care about my own and I care about science and learning about the truth and all these things, I feel like I've been given a few more trials than probably it would look like from the outside. You know, it looks like, oh, well, you kind of just got these sweet gigs and I wish I had a sweet gig like that. But really, I've had to deal with a lot of resentment in my life that I probably bring up on my own, like subconsciously.
What do you mean bring it up on your own?
Like, creating situations subconsciously where I feel I'm not getting my due, like, well, how come Justin Bieber's big and how, James Bay, the lovely and talented James Bay opened for me in Atlanta in 2013. How come he's big now? And like the lovely and talented Haim opened for Carney. Their first LA show was opening for us. And the wonderful, talented, these are all my friends, by the way. All the listening are friends of mine that I love and I'm so happy and successful. Mark Foster, Foster Peoples and all these amazing things. They opened for Carney back in the day. And One Republic actually opened for the Revolving Band. And now they're doing amazing things. And sometimes I've dealt with this thing of like, okay, like the John Bryans and Jack Whites of the world. And these sort of people respect kind of what Carney does. And like the Mike Elizondos of the world respect us. And the Don Was respect us. Why the heck? And my brother's in the Taylor Swift music video. And like, how come we're not on that mainstream? Like, what do we have to do? What are we doing wrong? So I've had a lot of internal sort of like, am I subconsciously creating a situation where like I have the musical love and appreciation and passion that allows these John Mayer types to respect me and work with me. But how come I haven't had a single or a thing that's, how come I can't play to 10,000 people? How come these people who opened for our bands can, but I can't? And so I've dealt with a lot of that, So when the Don Was thing happened, it was like another version of that. Like, dude, if only my manager would have done this thing a little bit differently, I should be playing Carnegie Hall now with my instrumental music. But so I deal with this resentment. I've even spoken to John about it, like, because he gets it. He knows that the sort of thing I'm striving for, I'm not there. But the sort of thing I'm striving for is to be 75 and be where Chick Corea is at. or Private Vincent. Yeah. I want to be there on the instrumental music scene, but I also want to be where the Who are, you know, or not the Who necessarily, because that probably never happened. That's from back in the day, but like where John Mayer is, or yeah. even James Mayer, or even Ed Sheeran. Like, I would like to have both things firing on all cylinders, because anyone who's met me for more than half an hour musically knows that I truly love orchestration, arranging, scoring, organization, but I also love free improv. And the closest analogy I can think of what I'd love to do is Amy Poehler, the actor.
Yeah. You know,
created UCB, which is an incredibly deep improv sketch comedy group. Like, that's a system now. And it was through her improv sketch troupe, ASCAT. But that's like UCB and Groundlings are the things, and Improv Olympic and shit. So those are things. Then she writes Parks and Rec, like writes great writing that's detailed and not improvised writing. And so for me, I truly want to do that in the music scene. I really want to do that. And thankfully on the underground, you know, not underground, but like in the music scenes, I play with John DeVerse, a big band, which got nominated for the Grammy thingies. That's why it says Grammy nominated in the whole bio that my manager wrote. But then I also play with John and I write my own, you know, quote unquote popular music songs. So I'm not even sure what I'm talking about now. I'm completely spitting.
I think what I understand totally what you're saying. And I don't think there's a person that is driven that doesn't think of that. And I will say this, and this is not like to sound, I hope it doesn't sound bad. When you're, the older you get, at least for me, I'm not going to make a generalization because I don't know how other people are. I became a lot more accepting of when, not less driven, but when things are meant to be, they work. You know, and all I got to focus on, I have this thing on my wall. It says, there's only three reasons you will not be successful. Number one, you don't try new things. Number two, you don't learn something from what you try. And number three, you give up. So for me, as long as I don't give up, I just learn to focus on what I can control, because I can't control, with rare exception, why. I mean, some things I have impacted why they didn't happen. But I try to say, okay, what did I get out of that? And, you know, what can I take away from that? But I totally understand what you're saying, man. It's a frustrating thing, and it's just a reality for everybody that's driven. You know, this guy one time said, he told me something like, it wasn't related to success or anything. It was totally out of context, but he said, this is going to happen, just not in your time frame.
Right.
That was like, really, yeah. I was really happy that he said that to me, because I've gone back to that and said, you know what? I'm not in charge here.
Yeah.
So I really have no right to impose my time frame on any, you know, whatever the situation is. So I've gotten able to sort of like not accept not being where I want to be, or not accept not getting something, but not accepting that that now is not the right time.
No, you're so right for so many reasons, dude. I mean, it's always good to hear that. I wouldn't even say it's always. I would say thank you for saying that is how I put that.
Yeah, because that's, and, you know, you may need to hear that again from three other guys.
Probably for the next 20 years, because I'm super dumb.
we all are, man. We all are. There's no. But
it's so true. I mean, I don't speak as someone who has, you know, really life experience in that awareness being settled. But I'm gathering, like, yeah, that is true, because it's you know, I've been through. I've been through enough things. I mean, the child acting does something interesting to your psyche. I wouldn't say it's a bad thing.
Yeah, what is that? What was the ramifications of that? Like, let me solidify the question I want to ask you. What was the good, the bad, and the ugly about that whole experience? Because that's not a normal, when I say not normal, not that it's bad. It's just not, it's a totally different way of growing up.
Totally. Yeah. Because it's interesting, as a kid, I think some people grow up without any sort of child labor or work, and they still kind of grow up with the same quirks that a professional child will grow up with. If they can convince themselves in their mind that their school situation is life or death, right? If they can convince themselves that this is life or death, you know, then some kids do wind up with the same sort of neuroses. But when you're a child actor, whether or not you feel that way, you feel the pressure that this show's going to be seen by a million people each week. And so there's no option to fail. Like, you need to get your lines right, or else we can't finish this scene. So there is a pressure that most children aren't used to, because most kids are used to, you know, I want to get A's, but I didn't. Okay, well, next time I will. But on the show, it's like, no, there's no next time. Like, right now, get it right, or else we can't move on.
And that's a lot of shit. A lot. Coping skills that you don't have at that age, period.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that was maybe the quote unquote bad, I guess. But at the same time, I feel like that was in some way a good.
Of course.
And all, the main good was the family I had grown up. It was like a total family. And now two of the members of the cast have passed away. And one of them meant a tremendous deal to me. First person who's passed away in my life that elicited any sort of emotional response from me. And I'm still sort of getting hit by it in waves because he was like my second dad in real life. But he was the star of the show.
That was Harry Anderson.
That was Harry Anderson, yeah.
What else was he in? Because I know his name.
Yeah, he was in Night Court.
Okay.
He was the star of that. He was the judge on it. And then he was on Cheers. He was Harry the Hat on Cheers, a guest star. He did a bunch of other stuff. He was also a very, very well-respected legend of magic. So he was like a comedian, magician, one of the first, actually, comedy magicians. And so he taught me magic tricks, you know, which allowed me to learn about to fall in love with discovery, which I think is really what's led to my guitar playing being the specific, you know, way that it's shown up. I'm really into, like, when I give private lessons or master classes at universities, for me, it's always about the, sucking as much nectar as I can. So if I'm doing my cage system, you know, all five shapes, I can know all five shapes. Awesome. They're automatic. But what I did as a 12-year-old, because I'm a nerd, is I would play this shape, and then I would say out loud in my bedroom, like a little weird kid, I would say G, A, B, C, D, E, F sharp, G, G, A, B, and I'd be seeing the shape in my head and on my hands. And then I'd do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1. Now, if it was the Dorian mode, I'd say 1, 2, flat, 3, 4, 5, raise 6, 7, 1. I sang it really sharp. Sorry, 7, 1.
Yeah, you just go through all the modes.
Yeah, and I'd do them on every shape, even the really confusing looking ones. So I'd learn the note names in that part of the fretboard. I'd learn the intervals as they relate to that root. Then I'd be an extra nerd and stay in that shape, but then change my mode in that shape. So, like, I'd be like in, eighth fret playing a C major scale. And I'd say, okay, well, these are the intervals if this is a C major scale. Then in my mind, I'd change it to the E Phrygian mode. And now I'd say the intervals as they relate to that, even though it's the same consistent shape. It's the same freaking notes exactly on that part of the fretboard. But my mind would shift to, well, if we're in E Phrygian, now this is the one. This used to be the three, now it's the one. So all this kind of fun stuff, I kind of learned that from Harry, how to like love discovery.
Yeah, but that, you know, that allowed you to learn the fretboard like no one's business.
Yeah, I really love that. For me now, when a key changes, and I talk to students about this, and I don't have that many students because normally I'm playing tours and stuff, but I'll do private lessons sometimes. But when I do them, it's fun because we'll talk with the students about this, how like when we change keys in a jazz setting, it's one thing to say, okay, well, this is a 2-5-1. So like I'll do Dorian for this 2-chord, I'll do mixolydian for the 5, and I'll do Ionian for the 1. It's one thing to say that. And then it's the next thing to say, well, these are all the same key signature. So you don't need to think about the mode. Just play one key signature and the chords will take care of it for you. So that's the next step. But the real next step to me is when the fretboard is like the matrix, the green code.
Yeah.
So when the key changes, the fretboard becomes B flat major. And when the key changes, the fretboard becomes G flat melodic minor, like the whole fretboard. And for me, the only way to do that is piecemeal and then doing my intervals and note names while I'm doing that piecemeal work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm working on now. I'm a lot far behind that, but I know I'm willingly taking a step back for like a year just to do that because I know I won't really know how to play unless I do
it's
that.
It's so fun too. It's really fun. Cause once you're like, oh, my ring finger is the major 7 now. And then the chord changes down to minor 3rd. Like, oh, my ring finger is now the 2. Whoa. Oh God. It starts to connect.
It's so fun. I'm not as enthusiastic as you are, but
I know.
Yeah.
I love this stuff. Oh, it's like my life passion. I love it. Yeah.
What you've played all over the world. And I was curious, what would you say the primary differences are between US audiences and audiences in other areas?
Well, my favorite audience is North Korea. No, okay. That's a weird joke. They just listen. They sure listen. I shouldn't even make a joke because it's like a total humanitarian civil rights crisis over there. But I shouldn't even made that. My bad. It's just a crazy. They need to get their
don't worry. No matter what you say, someone somewhere will be offended. So it's okay. Fair. You know,
that's fair. It
doesn't matter.
But so I was the second you started the question, I was thinking about that terrible joke. So I full on didn't even listen to the question. You said, what's my favorite place to play?
No, I said, what are the primary differences between US audiences and other audiences around the world?
This is a great question. So there are actually also primary differences in the US as well. But
talk about that too.
Yeah. So if I'm playing New York or LA, I generally am expecting the sort of influencer Snapchat crowd, you know? Now the good news is because I'm not really trying to just write songs that'll become catchy and be on the radio. I'm really trying to write based on my personal experience and let the chips fall where they may. Because of that, my audiences do tend to be pin drop. And I'm talking, I'm so lucky. I'm talking, I'll play El Rey Theater, which is a 775 seat theater in LA. I'll headline that myself. And I'll do it. I've done a show there once because I love solo shows. I did it with no band. I did it just with guitar and looping and a voice. And it was pin drop the whole time. And that's not really because it's just, I feel like when you're building the audience organically, it does take longer. You're chipping away brick by brick. But, you know, when you can do that, when it's really about the material, I will get lucky. But in general, if I'm playing with other artists, they're Snapchatty. They're sort of Starbucks drinking. You know, they want to say that they were there. So kind of vibe.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Whereas like Nashville, they really do listen. And then most of the South listens. Although as you get deeper into the South, the audiences get more rowdy. And so they want blues guitar solos a lot, it seems. And then I experienced in the Northwest a little more of like, I don't know what's the word. It's like an introspective crowd. I don't know. It feels like the beatnik spirit's still alive there. I don't know. Something like that.
This is really interesting. I've never heard anybody break this down like this.
Yeah, this is just my experience. And yeah, the thing is, I would say I've played, I think I did the math recently, and I think I've played, because live shows are my thing. That's like, we'll talk about recordings in a moment, but that's sort of been a hurdle for me that I finally started to cross. Literally the past month and a half, I've crossed this hurdle.
In live shows, as far as
no, recording shows. Oh, like recording live show. Is man, I've played. You know, I MD'd an artist named Katie Malua on Jimmy Kimmel Live, playing this freaking thumb. What do they call it? The false harmonic technique that I never do. And like I had live, and I felt fine. And I had Lyme disease for a while, and couldn't get out of bed. Couldn't even get out of freaking to do my dishes. And I did play with Joss Stone on Jimmy Kimmel as well. And like I felt fine about it. Like live, I just feel natural. And my first gig ever was at age 7 on an off-Broadway play called Nightmare 101. And I was the kid actor in this off-Broadway play. So I just love live performance. So I did the math, and I'm pretty sure, I'm not joking, if I were to include Dave's World, which is performed in front of a live studio audience, I mean, I'm playing like easily like, what was the number I came with? Like 5,000 shows, like some insane number. Wow.
Age, especially.
Yeah. And when I'm in LA, it's like, I'll sit in on so many gigs, and I don't know if I really include those just sitting in, but like, man, me coming up the ranks as a kid from 15, starting playing gigs at, you know, jazz clubs and blues clubs to like 22, I was just like gigging 5 nights a week. I mean, that was all the time. And so if you do the math there, that's like, you know, 300 some odd shows a year. Yeah. And then you start to add child acting. So it's just been a lot of live performance. Hmm. And so, yeah, I feel comfortable in front of an audience that's listening or one that's not. I've had some fun nights too, where it's a room that sets itself up to be a listening room. And a lot of people paid $20 to come see the show, and they're not getting their money's worth. And I'll look into the crowd, not angrily, but I'll sort of give a little bit of like a, if you're not going to listen, you can leave kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll hit like a loud note of my pog. Like I'll do a guitar solo that kind of sucks them in. It'll be really loud note, and then I'll look, and then half of them will stop talking to look up, and then I'll keep playing. And if the other ones don't play, I've stopped shows before in 100 seat small rooms where people are paying a lot of money to see like a private show. And I'll be like, listen, this isn't a corporate gig. This is like a concert. And like 75 people here are here to listen. I'm fine with you talking. I really am. I've played bar mitzvahs, and I've played live studio audiences, and I've done all that. Do whatever you want. But the people here probably don't like that you're talking, because they did pay good money to hear like guitar solos that are actually dynamic, you know? And so if you can leave if you'd like.
That's so funny. So what happens when that goes down?
They leave, and it's hilarious, and I love it, actually.
No, because it clears out all the...
Yeah, and I'll pay them back their money. If you didn't want to come to the show, if you came here to be part of a scene, because here's the other thing, and this is going to be the only name-droppy thing I'll really do in this podcast, but because of playing with different people, because of really caring about my craft and like loving the art of it and the fretboard and the theory and all that, like-minded people, we sort of connect together, you know?
Yeah.
So because of this, you know, Evan Rachel Wood and I started this band. And she's like one of my best friends, but she's like one of the best actors in the world right now, in my opinion. And she respects me in that way as a guitar player and a musician and a songwriter. So we gravitate towards each other because of this. Friends that come to my shows, you know, Jeremy Renner came to a show, and then Ruby Rose came to a show, and then, you know, Avril Lavigne comes to a show. They come to sit in the audience to see these shows, right? So when they're there, and then people are still talking around them, here's why it usually happens. They know Ruby Rose is in the audience. They know Keegan Allen's in the audience, who's a fantastic young actor. The point is, they'll come to these shows, celebrities are there. Now the people want to come to just see the celebrity watch a show, and they're talking and Snapchatting about it. It's like, dude, that's not, no. I don't know if you noticed that person you respect, that celebrity in the audience, James Valentine will come to the show. They're here to listen.
Yeah.
Follow their lead. And if you're not going to, you got to leave. Because this music, it matters too much to me. I mean, for me, I very much see myself doing like a PBS special one day, a la Bobby McFerrin, you know? Like, that's the sort of music I want to make. And I go to concerts and I'm that listener. When I go to a Trick Corea show and someone starts talking, I'm like, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I really feel like I need to listen to this. Like, and I say that. It's like, you know, I'm nice. You know, I'm not angry.
Yeah, but
notes right now that are going to impact my heart and your heart. And we're going to go home changed. And I want to experience that selfishly. Sure. Also, I want to respect him because he's on stage. But really selfishly, I want to do it for me.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you pay to see a show, man. You know, it's the worst when someone's screwing up your shit.
Totally. Yeah. Now, that being said, when you go to a Government Mule show and they're shouting during solos, I love that. Yeah. I love it all. So to finish answering your question, Tokyo, they will listen until about 5 seconds after the song. And I love that because my brand of music is very jazz and classical on the dynamic tip. Sort of film score. I sort of do like a soundtrack moments in my show. Like, it needs to be a listening crowd. So I love Japan. Copenhagen's like that as well. Very respectful. France, they erupt after songs. It's like a beautiful sort of passion thing. I mean, these sort of sound like stereotypes for the countries, but they've lined up in the shows.
That's cool, man. No, thanks for explaining all that.
Yeah, man.
So let me ask you this. Did you grow up in New York or because you said
I did.
Whereabouts?
Manhattan, 17th between 5th and Broadway.
Oh my God. What a freaking amazingly cool location.
I know.
Oh my God.
No, and I was in like I was born in 85. So like that was till 97.
That is so cool.
Dude, roller hockey was a thing in Union Square at that time.
Yeah, I love Union Square. Oh, I was just there in May. I love it. I'm from there. But that's so cool, man.
Oh, wait, man. Where are you from?
From the Bronx, though. Not from the night. Not from 17th Street. I love that. I hung out in the Village every weekend of my life when I was a kid. Whenever we go back, that's where we just stayed at the Hyatt down in Union Square.
Yeah, sure.
I love that
whole
area. It's just so cool, man.
Awesome.
So what was your childhood like? I get the sense that like you obviously had an acting family or an arts inclined family.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, my dad was a jingle writer in New York City when the jingle scene was like the thing.
Wow.
So he worked with Will Lee and Lenny Pickett and all those guys.
Yeah.
And he actually wrote the song that eventually they snipped to a 2-second clip, and that was Anything Goes with Play-Doh. Like, he wrote that. This whole song, he used that. So he basically wrote that big, you know, childhood thing. And he also wrote, co-wrote Hands Across America with, like, you know, they did that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was him. My mom went to CCM, Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, studied music theater, musical theater and music theory. And we'd sing, you know, Beatles songs in the car and do 5-part harmony. So it was definitely Partridge Family-esque.
Okay. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Hamilton High School in Los Angeles.
Okay, so how did that – when did you move out to L.A.?
From age 7 to 12, I was bi-coastal because of Dave's World, the sitcom I was on.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the that's kind of tough, I would imagine. I mean, we talked a little bit about
it. Yeah, it was weird, man. I remember also at 13, I learned about subconscious things, which is why kind of my life journey is like unpacking – things that are conscious and then unpacking things that are unconscious or subconscious. Cause I remember saying at 12 or 13, oh man, I want to get married one day and I want to keep the family together and I don't want to ever move them out to a different city. Like, I was saying this, not realizing that's literally what I did.
Yeah.
So I moved my family and then we permanently moved. So sometimes you say things that are, you know, fears that are things you've already done.
Well, man, it sounds like you're at least in touch with what's going on in there, man, which I think, you know,
I try to be.
I think not, you know, lack of awareness is such a big problem, to be honest with you, you know.
Yeah, that's why it troubles me, the music that's coming out now. And people sometimes say that I'm like a grandpa or like, come on, man, just have fun, like relax. But it's just not in my spirit or nature. I really, to me, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and Neil Young and James Taylor, like, cool, that's mining for truth through really tough experiences and then sharing their experience, strength and hope, which is a term my friends use in 12-step. I'm not in 12-step, but I've heard that term. But so it's like, yeah, that's what an artist, in my opinion, artists are teachers and healers. And right now, unfortunately, because of the economy and the nature of our political system and just all this crap going down, in the world, there's a lot of a desire to run away from feelings, a huge desire in the art scene. And even the love songs have become more toxic, in my opinion. Like, they used to be about, like, you know, to really love a woman, Bryan Adams, you know, whatever. Now they're like all about this, like, chaotic, like, if you don't love me, like, as long as you, as long as you, like, really? Like, that's another stuff. Like, guys, stop. Justin's music.
That's so classic.
But it's just like, dude, really? Because what about like Bill Nye or Neil deGrasse Tyson? Like, how about just like learning what the truth is and being okay with the truth on truth's terms? Or as, again, my 12-step friends would say, life on life's terms. And I have tons of 12-step friends because LA is like the hub of 12-step life. So I know a lot of these things. But
can I tell you something funny? Not to interrupt you. When I first started this podcast, right, I was like, man, how do I get good guests? And I had like three different people out in LA said, man, you need to come to the rooms out here.
Yes, seriously.
Seriously. I mean, they were like, man, just come to the rooms. And you're like, totally, I was like, dude, I'm not going to come to the rooms.
I've audited some classes in the rooms. I mean, not for substance. I don't do substances, but just like, you know, having family. My grandpa was an alcoholic. And so, and he, you know, passed away when my dad was young. And so I've investigated things. And
there's a lot of wisdom in that just with as like normal coping.
Totally, you man. Know, dude, it's awesome. Al-Anon's amazing.
And that's where I heard that expression, actually. I knew somebody that was going through in the program, and I was talking to their sponsor, and I was concerned about them, and they said, look, they're going to get it, just not on your time frame.
Yeah,
That was where I got that from.
Awesome. Love it.
And like I said, that was like, I'm so glad I heard that because it just, great. I'm good with that now.
You know? Totally, man. But so, yeah, so musically, I feel like the urban, not urban, that's the wrong term. I hate that term, actually. But the sort of like the mumble rap that's out right now, whatever that thing is, there's a lot of music that's, I get it. It's good, though. I think it's good also to write music that's about like, here are the feelings I'm going through. And maybe I am doing a lot of Molly, or maybe I'm whatever, doing this stuff. But that's not the music I'm ever going to write.
Yeah. Because to me,
I will listen to someone with compassion when they have a struggle. I will always do that. But when I speak, it has to be grounded in some sort of supportive, encouraging, building sort of sense. And so musically, when I write songs, it has to be in that sense. Anyway.
It's funny, when you play guitar, I've watched a lot of videos of you before, you know, in prepping for this. And your whole body language is like super intense. Like it's very... You know, you could tell you're in the headspace there, and you're very present when you're doing this. It's like you're in, you know, that zone. And I thought that was really cool because, you know, that's the people you want to hear playing music. You know, the guy that's like, you know, looking on his fucking cell phone while he's, you know, while he's getting warmed up. Maybe not so much. You got to wonder, like, you know, if it means nothing to you, it's certainly going to mean nothing to me.
Right.
You know? Wow.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you noticed that.
No, I totally did. What were some of the bigger surprises for you? And maybe not so much because you came up in acting, but when you first started playing professionally, like about the business end of being a musician?
Yeah. I noticed that labels are, I wouldn't even say labels, industry people that seek to help artists become successful. I've noticed that like 95% of them, while some of them are well-meaning, I say 95% of them, how do I put this? I shouldn't give this much of a generalization. Let's back that down to 75%. they're just, I experience them in a way that is not, an enjoyable for a working relationship.
So it's disingenuous, their intentions.
If I can really say what I've said privately to my friends, I've been like, man, they're really bad at their job. Like a lot of these people, and it's kind of mean to say it that way, but I feel like it takes a really lucky sort of stroke of luck maybe to have like a great team that really understands how to really support an artist and get their music heard. A lot of people seem to want to just latch on when there's something easy. And I get that. I mean, trust me, I don't want to always play gigs for the rest of my life where I'm building from the ground up, like a new band starting at 10 people. I want to, you know, hop on a John Mayer train or an Avril Lavigne train. It is fun to do that. But the industry is tough. It's really tough.
And, as far as competency.
Yeah, it feels that way. I mean, it feels like for me right now, I'm doing the solo artist thing. And there's some label interest, but they're waiting for me to send them recordings, which has been a hurdle until recently. Cause my spirit's very improvisatory. And also I can't make music on a laptop. I mean, a computer's involved, I have to start with tape and then dump it into Pro Tools. And then it's just, that's the only way I can make music is being truly inspired sonically. Mm-hmm. And I don't do that when it's a mediocre mic in my home studio. Yeah. So I think a lot of it's kind of working with the industry side of things. So I found that right now in this current climate, because of YouTube, because of Spotify, because of TuneCore, because we can do most of it ourselves, these industry people kind of expect us to do all of it ourselves and then hand us a finished product, 100,000 Instagram followers. And then, oh, great. Well, now we'll latch on. We'll take 15% and we'll open this door for you to these people. And what I've learned is, because of playing with Avril Lavigne, writing with her, because of working with John Mayer, because of even this band with Evan Rachel Wood, those doors are kind of open already for me. Like, I don't really need a gatekeeper. So I'm not even sure if I need management right now. I have management. They're amazing, but they haven't really done anything the past 8 months. And they know that. I'm like, listen, I got to do this myself. I know what I'm doing. I'm following the navigation thing. Just trust me here and we'll talk. They're like, dude, that's totally fine. Long story short is the industry people, they tend to want to ride a wave that's a trend. And then every now and then you meet an industry person who sees a real thing about to happen. Like, oh, this is the next wave. And that's kind of what I tend to want to find. Like, cause I feel like my stuff is never going to be really that, current. I'm not going to follow the sounds or lyrics of my current thing unless it lines up perfectly and everyone starts doing what I'm doing, but I'm going to be doing what I'm doing no matter what is my point. I don't like following trends. So that's just where I'm at. So industry wise, it's tough. It's tricky. But I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunities I've been given that allow industry people to, respect me and respect my craft. So I always feel like I have allies, you know?
Very cool, man. Yeah. Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. You got nice shit ton of cool looking guitars on your wall there. What is your go-to guitar right now? And maybe what other two guitars would round out your top three?
You know, the go-to, it's probably this Monterado Guitars viola guitar. So yeah, it's this guy, Kelly Monterado, based in Colorado. Most people have seen me play a Tele, a blue Tele.
Yeah, that's what I've seen you play. That's kind of that one right up there in the corner, right? Is it
over there? It's different than that one. That was the one I used on Spider-Man.
Okay. By the way, do you know Jake Schwartz, Jake Ezra Schwartz from Broadway? He does a lot of stuff on Broadway.
And I was such a rogue. I kind of came in, I was like a hired gun, and then I went back to LA. So I don't really know the scene as well as I should.
No, totally cool.
But so yeah, guitar wise, that Monterado I'm using on tour with Johnny, and then I'm using it at my solo shows. Hmm. Like my solo Zane Carney headlining shows.
Is it like a Tele also?
It's like shaped like a Tele. Here's the cool part. So my Tele, my blue guitar is kind of my main thing that I play with Mayer and Carney and all that stuff. And recording wise, I use it all the time. Then I have the Hofner Jazzica, which is like the quote unquote Zane Carney signature guitar. Mm-hmm. The Monterado is kind of a split between those two because it's a full hollow body, but it's shaped like a Tele, but the pickups are humbuckery, but there's this beautiful split coil thing you can do. And it sounds very woody and dead and sort of, it leans more towards the T-Bone Burnett, John Bryan, Blake Mills, kind of that land.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tele, which is more like a piercing, or Jeff Buckley kind of thing. So I love that audiophile, hearing the tubes really speak, spongy, woody sound. And so the Monterado is doing that for me right now.
And then the Hofner's second, and what would be number three?
I would say the Tele's second and the Hofner's three, which is a really bad advertisement for my signature guitar that people can go buy at zanecarney.com. Like, crap.
No, but it is what it is. I mean, it's
what it is right now. Now, that being said, the Monterado is kind of a master of all things, or jack of all trades. It's not a master of none. It's a master of its own thing, but it's a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
The Hofner is its thing. And so if I have more space on tour in my guitar rack, I always have the Hofner.
If I ask you to pick musically, like your top three Desert Island discs, but let me make it easier for you in no particular order. Just for today, tomorrow, it could be three other ones. What's your knee jerk reaction to be right now?
Ooh. I think Aerosmith Nine Lives has to be on there. I've loved that record since I was 12 when it came out, 11 when it came out. Aerosmith Nine Lives. I haven't listened to this record in so long, but I could probably spin James Taylor's October Road a lot. Oh, and then Morten Lauridsen's Lux Aeterna. Morten Lauridsen is a composer, the Los Angeles Master Chorale, and I've played that record more than any other record in my life.
Really?
It's four different pieces. Lux Aeterna, or no, it's four movements of Lux Aeterna and Omnium Mysterium. Yes, it's two pieces on there. Yeah, Stephen Layton conducted it. It's the Los Angeles Master Chorale sings it. It's next level. It's incredible.
So you like a, what do you call it? Like a I'm getting the sense that you have sort of genius, fleeting in and out of genius for some reason.
Oh, I love that. I mean, you mean like as far as this, I love genius artists, you mean?
No, I get the sense that like you're like a highly intellectual guy.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you get like,
genius? Oh, thanks, man.
Jeez. Yeah, like I don't know why. It's just like you get that your brain is, but like so much so that your brain is on fire smoking sometimes.
Oh, that part I will definitely agree with. Whether or not I'm a genius, I don't know about that. But the left and right brain are connected in a really aggressive way for me. I love math and science. I took AP Calculus BC senior year and like, you know, passed the test and stuff. I like love math. But I also love reading Bukowski, who I see on your wall. And I love reading St. Augustine. And I love reading this new book right now, The Brain That Changes Itself, about neuroscience. And I really love nerdy shit. But then when I'm making art, to me, it's all about applying it to my form of communication. And I really think that, like, you know, people talk about like, oh, you're an artist, your gift was to give us a guitar, this and that. I really feel like gifts are more nuanced than that. And I, you know, like an athlete might be, oh, your gift's to play football. Well, that's an amazing part of the actual gift you have. And so for me, I feel like my life purpose is communicating. I don't know, like maybe that's supporting or uplifting or encouraging. Maybe it's revealing. I don't know, but I feel like I love communicating.
Like and you're so a connector.
And so for me, the guitar is a way to do that. If I could say to you in 37 words, something I'm feeling, which hopefully would communicate it. And I also could play two chords and that would communicate it as well. Mm. And I could also, you know, if someone says, I want to know about this Dorian mode, I'll say, okay, well, here are the scale degrees. If you were considered a scale, here's a notice in the start on in a key signature. So you can know how to create it that way. Here are some chords it'll work over. And then also here's an analogy. So if I were to say this sentence, you know, oh, I'm, you know, I've lost my way. And I said that to someone where I'm on my knees crying. You're going to say, oh no, his life has ended. Oh God, this is so sad. But if I said, I've lost my way, when I see two really hot girls walk by and my wife, that's funny, you know, and modes are just that.
Yeah.
It's a key signature said from a different point of context. So I can communicate it. I like to communicate it that way with a story, or I can play it for you. Or so I love connecting the dots. And so, yeah, at a young age, I felt like the right brain and the left brain were sort of like intermixed. So, and that's one thing I love about John Mayer. You know, I do it very differently. I think we have different ratios of the left and right brain, but, I really love, I like being in any situation and being able to connect with someone. So I would love to meet Neil deGrasse Tyson one day and give him a big hug and be like his best friend. And then I'd also love to talk with Joan Baez one, you know, it's just like, I just feel like I like it all. And yes, my brain is on fire and I need help, but I go to therapy, so I think I'm going to be okay.
Hey, what's your best childhood memory? I like that shirt, man. I remember when album came out.
Yeah, man. You know what's really messed up? I don't even know this album.
So you're kidding me.
No, before I answer your question about my childhood memory, my thing is really like I just described, connection and communication. Music language, music theory. That's my thing. Music history, I'll get an F- on it. There are so many records I don't know about. There are so many artists and liner note things I have no clue about. Thank God my saving grace is once I start playing, Don Wells will go like, okay, let's work together. Daniel Lenoir will be like, let's work together. I'm like, because if they knew that I didn't know that Fleetwood Mac was by – there's a guy named Mick Fleetwood. Like I learned that a couple days ago. Like, okay, got it. Cool. I just knew that they're a band. They have that song True. Okay.
Oh, yeah, but you're also not – you didn't grow up with them. It's like –
you're giving me the benefit of the doubt. No, it's really bad. Trust me. It's bad.
Let me tell you, because a lot of times I interview people and I'll tell them point blank, I'm not familiar with your music. And I'm okay with that because cannot possibly be familiar with everybody's. It's totally. Not possible. If you're offended by that and don't want to have a conversation, that is totally cool. You're prerogative. But I just want you to be upfront that I don't know, or I don't like this kind of music, or it's not my thing, you know, but this show is really more about you, not your music. So it's not.
That being said, I'm in the bottom 5 to 10 percentile of people who like music history or industry stuff. I know industry stuff, but not history stuff. So,
and in spite of that, you still got to play for John Mayer.
Yeah, because to me the length is so far, because that's the connecting dot.
Yeah, right. So what does it matter? You know, no one's never going to get a gig or not get a gig because you didn't know Mick Fleetwood.
That being said, if someone says play like an African thing, I'll be like, oh, cool. I learned this from when I played with Armand Sabaleko, and this is a West African thing, and I know that. And someone says like play like a 50s modal thing, I'm like, well, that wasn't really modal yet, but I know what you mean, like late 50s or early 60s. Okay, I'll do that. I know that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
the language stuff, but the art, like all the artists that were bebop players, I'll be like, I know jazz more than anything as far as liner notes, but that's my most. I mean, jazz is, at the end of the day, you said something very funny before we started when I was getting my hair ready. Like, oh, you're a rock star. I'm like, oop, no, I'm not. Don't do drugs. Don't party. Don't really do any poses on stage that look rock star-y. I really am a jazz nerd who dresses like a rock musician. I full on am a jazz nerd. But so you asked me what my favorite childhood memory was.
Correct.
And I would say, God, it'll just have to be the first thing that comes to mind because I've never even thought of that. Easy. So easy. The best. Getting Zelda the Ocarina of Time for Christmas and playing it in my bedroom.
You know, it's funny. I remember buying that for my son who's just a few years younger than you.
It was just – I couldn't believe the storyline. I couldn't believe that.
That's so funny.
Just the best.
The ocarina, and then I bought him an ocarina. I was like a little musical instrument. It was so funny, man.
I love it.
Hey, this might be a dangerous question. Tell me something about yourself, Zane, that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd. Can open up all sorts of can of worms and shit here.
Other than eating my own earwax? No, I'm kidding. That's such a gross joke. No, I would say, I mean, I think generally people, when they see me perform and I have dark hair and pale skin, and I dress sort of like a pirate meets like a pauper from the 16th century mixed with like, you know, I don't know. I dress like a maniac a little bit sometimes. And I wear guy liner sometimes on stage and all that stuff. I think people perceive me as very mysterious and like hard to reach and like, who's this guy with this hair kind of draping over his face? And then when they meet me, they're like, oh, you're like – generally I'm a bit of a teddy bear, you know. I very much care about people's feelings. I'm empathetic. I'm not the guy backstage hooking up with the groupies because I'm too busy, you know, thinking about the fretboard in my head like a super nerd. And then I go out and sell my merch, and then I categorize my merch to make sure it's, you know, I make a living off doing this. This is how I make my living, and I'm very grateful for, like, I am financially solvent and have savings. So like, it matters to me. This stuff matters.
That's why you're financially solvent. You have savings because it matters.
Yeah, totally.
And it's not like random luck.
No, it's fun to me. Like, I love all of it. But so that might be something that would surprise people. But the thing that might be off is, to speak to that a little more, I also, you know, I'm single right now, and I've been single for a long time, mainly because of, loving having orgies. No, I'm totally kidding. I've never even had a threesome. I'm totally joking. No, I'm not cool. Like I said, I'm zero cool.
Wait a minute. Zane's taking applications though.
Yeah,
for his first threesome.
Supposed to give me my first.
For his first threesome.
Here's the problem with threesomes though, and my mom she'll hear this and she'll hopefully laugh at this because she'll know that I still am that good young boy that I was. Here's the thing about them. You can't really have one unless you're like into like drugs or ecstasy or like getting drunk. Cause like, how does that start? Are you going to start that? Like, hey guys, you want to just start it? No, you have to be like totally by high your mind. So that's never going to happen to me. I don't need it to or want it to. I'm fine. But anyway, so the whole thing with,
I can't say this hasn't been a diverse conversation, man. That's for sure.
There you go.
There isn't much we haven't covered.
There we go. Well, cause you're a great interviewer.
Thank you.
But you're
a good person to talk to, man.
Yeah, man. So the whole thing is, what were we talking about before?
Saying I'm single. I've been single for a while now.
Oh, yeah. So why did I bring that up? Because of dating.
About people would be surprised to hear you might find.
Oh yeah. Oh, that like there's a guy. There's a whole thread here, and then I made a gross joke because I love doing that. All my friends know that I go a little too far sometimes with my humor and confuse people.
You said you've been single for a while now, and people will be surprised to hear that. And you started to say why, but then you got interrupted. You say, well, because
it happens from time to time. My brain just totally farts. But I would say I was probably bringing that up.
That will get worse.
I'm doing that thing that kids do when they're like five, where they add words that aren't necessary for the sentence. Like, I would say that if I were to concur this about this, just true. This moment, I would say. Maybe people would be surprised to know that. Here's what I was gonna say. I've gone on some dates recently. You know, I'm single, and sometimes girls are like, "Oh, you're so bohemian. Like, you're so, you know, you probably have nothing organized." And I'm like, "Actually, look at my eye."
No, this guy is like,
I'm like so organized,
so anal. Yeah, like, guitars are alphabetized. I think over there, man.
I'm not that far, but I would love to do that. Sounds good. But so I love that. That detail. And I'm like an entrepreneur. I mean, I grew up, for some reason, I had this entrepreneurial spirit, probably because of child acting. So I'm really into it. And so people are surprised to find that out. So that's just highlighting the surprise thing. The off-putting thing is, or maybe he's like, oh, what's wrong with him? Might be, let me see. Like a weird thing that I do.
How do you meet women, like online?
It depends. I mean, I'll meet them at shows, which is sometimes tough because I think most people that go to shows, I'd say about 80 to 90% are like part of like having fun in those scenes. Like, oh, again, and I'm not like against substances. I just don't drink because I don't like the taste of it, but I'm not sober or anything. Hmm. But it's usually more of like a let's be fun and be like weird and like stay up late and be kind of freaky. Yeah. Whereas for me, if I like want to have a fun late night, it'll literally be playing with some friends, like, you know, Nintendo 64 games or like, yeah, talking in my backyard about like the nature of the cosmos. Like, that actually gets me excited. So when I go to gigs and meet girls there, they're probably
not going to come home and talk about the cosmos.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's fine.
Throwing a dart out there.
Now, they may be into that, like a guy like that. But to me, I'm really interested in meeting a girl who,
Need to go to like planetarium.com or some,
yeah, exactly,
you know, some.
But that being said, I definitely am on Raya, which like my friends told me to get on, which
what is that?
It's like an industry dating app that like actors and musicians.
Oh yeah, that's probably good.
Yeah. So I am on that and I'll meet people there sometimes. And I've met some really lovely people the past couple of years.
Do you want to give people your handle?
My handle on Raya? Yeah, I wish there was that. Oh man. It's the only problem with Raya is it's like an exclusive thing, which I hate being part of like anything exclusive.
Oh, you have to get an invite.
Yeah. It's like a whole like, oh, you're part of this. Oh, you know these people. So that means you're part of this community. Cool. You're allowed in. And I'm the most, that's like the most antithetical thing to my spirit as far as making friends and caring for people. But I do like meeting people that are painters. It's cool. Like, oh, you're a painter. I like that. You're, you know, we probably share the same schedule, you know, as far as staying up late. Let's hang out.
Plus you don't have to limit anybody you meet to exclusively to that app.
Exactly.
You know, it's just another vehicle.
Exactly. But yeah, so that's the thing that I guess that's off about me is I'm,
what is that thing called? Raya? I never heard of it.
Yeah. R-A-Y-A.
R-A-Y-A.
Yeah.
People are going to think I'm an affiliate or something like that. I just never heard of it.
No, I know.
I wouldn't know. I've been with my wife 26 years. I wouldn't know any of these things. I mean,
of course.
Sometimes my older son, but now he's in a relationship. So I used to like get some intel, but I'm sort of like in the
dark. Yeah, right. No, yeah. Dating is interesting in LA. But I guess the most off thing, like specifically, is like I played Pokemon a lot as a kid. Like I'm a true nerd, and that's pretty much all I can think of that's off.
You probably have
some great questions coming up too, and I want to answer them.
Who's had the biggest influence on your life? That was a really good segue, by the way. I like that.
Yeah, right?
You probably have some really good questions. Like,
On the musical tip, definitely Wes Montgomery. Because that changed the trajectory of my life. I mean, he's the first person I heard as an improviser, and he's one of the greatest of all time. So I was like, oh, this is how my brain works. And I told my whole family, this is the music I like. And they said, oh, we don't really listen to jazz. I'm like, well, this is how my brain works. And I'm going to only listen to this from here on out. and thus began like 8 years of hardcore shedding.
Man, have you ever listened to some guy? Have you ever? I recently saw a documentary on Netflix about Nat King Cole and his guitar player when he had this trio. His name is like, I think like Oscar Moore or something. Oh my God. There's some stuff on YouTube. The guy was just.
Oh, I got to check him out.
Oh my God. It's like awesome. Brilliant. I mean, it's really amazing.
Love Nat King Cole.
Sorry. So Wes Montgomery on the music side, personally.
I mean, my mom has been the most involved. So I would definitely think she's been, because my parents got divorced when they were 12, when I was 12, and I still talk to my dad all the time. Oh, this yawning. I'm sorry. But my mom was the most involved from age like 7 to 18, because she came on the set with me every day at Dave's World. So I saw her all the time. And then from 12 to 18, when they got divorced, my dad moved away to Orange County. And so we mostly had full custody with my mom.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, she's an amazingly strong woman. I learned a lot from her. I mean, we're starting to really develop a really great relationship too, because I think divorced children and children who act, like, there's always a weird relationship with your parents. She wasn't a stage mom at all. But there's always a weird like confusion that I think sometimes the parents even don't understand.
Yeah, I can see that, man.
I think it's more about like, oh, I hate you, but it's more like, no, I just, my brain chemistry was formed during a really weird time where I had a job. And like, this isn't even personal sometimes. It's just like the relationship for me needs to be really clear. Like, are you my mom or my friend? Like, I need to know.
Or my manager.
Yeah. So I think we're developing an even stronger relationship recently with more boundaries and clarity, and both of us taking care of ourselves the way we need to. And I think she'd agree with that. But I also have a lot of my dad in me. I mean, when I was a kid, he would sit on the toilet closed, you know, he would sit on there while I was like 5, 7 years old taking showers. And we talk about Nietzsche and we talk about Albert Camus.
Wow. About, like I said, I thought you had this brain, you know, just intelligence thing going on. You could just sort of,
well, I don't know if I even was born with it. My dad definitely, he saw that I was interested in these things. I mean, I remember at age four, one of the first philosophical questions that I was posed, I was 4 years old, and my dad, for some reason, knew I could handle it. And so we talked about it for about 20 minutes. I was four, maybe five. But we're driving around, and he goes, hey, Zane, did you ever realize and notice that everything that's above the ground was once in the ground? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, all the trees, you know, grew up from the soil, but also all the buildings were mined from metals, and like all those mountains were, you know, I'm like, whoa. And then the concept kind of didn't stick yet, but it was more like, whoa, like this could be a barren waste. Like, and instead things grow. Like, what does that mean for things to grow? Or then like, wait, does it come from the earth? Like, what does the earth come from? And like, so we would talk about these when I'd be in my shower sessions, you know, talking to my dad, like, well, if the universe, like if black holes exist, could we be inside of one? He's like, we could be inside. I mean, it's like, whoa. Okay. So I love curiosity. I mean, if I were to say like my five deepest traits, you know, it would be reflexes. Like I love reflex. I love like when I played baseball, I would, like a grounder never got by me. Like I'm into like when I've dropped like my shampoo bottle, like I always catch it. Like I'm into reflex and quick, like, oh, connecting dots. So it's a big part of my brain pattern and my spirit, I guess. But then curiosity is a huge part of it, which I think would be part and parcel to figuring out how things work. That'd probably be number three, like how do things work? The underlying nature of things. And then I love communication. I love like that. And then I love connecting. So those are kind of my five like guides in life. And then that, if that leads to things that you, I think hopefully mistakenly are experiencing as genius, tight. But I have a lot of passions, you know?
Well, you know, just so you know, most kids at four are trying to just figure out why they can't have an unlimited amount of Oreos. They're not talking about Camus
There is one story.
Anything philosophical.
There is one story my mom shares about me that highlights the nature of my curiosity about life. My brother was shoving these Cheerios up his nose when he was like five or six. He would shove them up there. And I was three or so. And I would stare at them for like an hour. And I would just rotate them. And knowing myself, I'm gathering probably what I thought was something like this. Like, okay, now when I look at it from the side, I can't see through it. And then when I rotate, I can see through it. So what is that? So that means there's a hole. But like, I get there's a hole, but also – so things can be impenetrable and then you just rotate and now they're viewable. Now you can see through them. Is that true in the rest of life? Like that's just kind of how the brain works. Like, wow. And like there's also little holes inside, but I can't see through those, but I know that they're holes because there's a bit of a hole and like that's a gap. And what is a gap? And so I didn't have words as a child, but I was like, that's probably what I was staring at for an hour. Now, when I go to music theory, Wow. It's like, well, we're in Dorian, but Dorian is real similar to melodic minor. And if I'm in melodic minor, well, then I'm kind of in a really fucked up, pardon my French, major scale, you know, augmented, as they call it, the leading augmented mode. So if I'm in Dorian, like, can I imply that, can I superimpose that beautiful, ethereal, haunting melodic minorness? Sure. Yeah.
Wow. You know,
things like that.
I'm exhausted, man.
Yeah, I know. 10 hours of sleep. People make fun of my friends. Make fun, like, "Oh, I only get 5 hours of sleep." I'm like, "Well, I need 10, so just get off my back, because my brain is hyperactive for the 14 hours I'm awake, and then I need 9 to 10 hours sleep."
Yeah, my younger son's like that. Yeah. Hey, three more questions, man. And any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Yeah, retro video gaming. That's kind of my thing. So there was a period last summer where I was collecting and trading and stuff, but I have about, not a huge collection, but like 70 NES games, you know, little cartridges. Some of them are really valuable. About 55 Super Nintendo games, about 35 N64 games, and then a bunch of old systems. The Nintendo, Sega Genesis, Sega Nomad. I have two of those. It's a portable Genesis. I have like 5 or 6 Game Boys.
You should bring them out on your merch account, and you have those all like locked up. Well, that stuff locked up. People are like, "Oh, is that like limited edition records?"
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
Fuck that, man. It's an old Nintendo game. You want to buy it, you better pony up.
Totally. No, and I've gone through phases in my life where I'll go to bed every night on YouTube watching like GameSack, which is like the nerdiest of nerdy YouTube channels. So I'm into that stuff. I think that's partially too because of the child acting. I had a wonderful childhood, but I definitely worked 100,000 times more than most kids do for those 6-7 years I was acting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so I think it's like a nostalgia thing, like, "Oh, that was my childhood. Like, I want to go back there even stronger than I think most normal people. Like, oh, I love seeing 8-16-bit graphics, Mega Man X2. Like, oh, yes, I love watching someone play that. Even if I don't play it, I love it."
Well, it was probably like you probably had so much responsibility all the time that you – the times you didn't have it were like really, you know, emotionally comfortable for you. Like, wow, yeah. I could just like be, you know, 5 or 7, you know?
Yeah, man. So. That's why I don't want a mom. You know, people say, "Oh, guys always want to marry a mom." I don't want that, but for a lot of reasons. But I do want like a fun play partner, you know, because I have a hard time playing. I'm really good at like learning and growing and listening and da, da, da. But I wouldn't mind someone like a touch from someone on the shoulder where I'm like, "Oh, let's just play. You know, like, let's just like be children and be wacky and just like, you know, play some video games." So that's something that I probably would be like a requisite in a relationship. Someone who's not like I am, someone who's much more relaxed and goes with the flow and let's just relax for 30 minutes. Let's relax for 2 hours. And maybe the video game thing would become just, you know, going to laser tag or something. which I also love. I love nerdy stuff. So, yeah, that was question number. You had 3 more questions, so that was one of them.
Can you, number 2, talk about a specific experience that either changed your life or altered the way you think about things?
Oof, jeez. We probably already dipped into 2 or 3 of them. The West Montgomery thing, the conversation with my dad. A more deep one would be when in 2015 I was doing headlining touring in Europe. John Mayer had been texting me. He was really nice to me. He's like, "Dude, everyone's talking about you. Like, there's a lot of buzz around you. When you come back, it'll probably be really cool." And then the last day of my tour, I got what we discovered was Lyme disease, like really bad. And so thus began about 3.5 years of like torment and confusion that ended February of this year. So it was just like a real rough, almost 3 years of just like kind of hell. And so I was in and out of bed. I'm talking like fatigue, not tired, not cough, pick it up, nothing will do it.
You okay now?
Yeah. So we discovered that maybe it wasn't Lyme. Maybe it was generalized anxiety disorder because I started taking Lexapro, which is like a mental health, you know, it's for anxiety and depression, I guess. Mm-hmm. Started taking that and going to therapy. And now my energy levels are through the roof like they used to be.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I get tons of sleep at night and I feel great and rejuvenated. So I never felt that in those 3 years. I felt like good for a month or two, but I always felt like I'm about to break. And now I just feel like myself again. So,
You could tell you're burning lots of energy, man, mentally, and you got to sleep. A guy like you.
Yeah. And I'm really grateful with life right now. I think even in the past 6 months, I've gotten to that age where I really, like, I love my little silver streak in my hair. Like, I love it now.
Better gray than bald, bro.
Yeah, right. I like that. Sometimes I'll listen back to interviews I do, you know, and I'm like, "Ah, oh, I sound so emo." And now I'm like, "Well, who cares? Like, I am a bit like, I'm not emo in like the goth sense, but like, yeah, sometimes I sound a little cheesy and mushy. Like, cool, great. I don't care if someone judged me for that. Like, I don't need to judge myself for that.
Not your problem, man.
Yeah, like, I like who I am. I'm also something that would surprise people to kind of answer this question too. Like, the question you had before, I'm really into sports. I've never not confused a girl I'm dating. I've had 4 long-term girlfriends, all about, you know, a year to 2.5 years. Every one of them, about 2 months in, goes like, you know, I didn't think this was the sort of guy I was dating, but I'm in. And I'm like, what kind of guy do you think you were dating? They're like a bohemian, like feeler, like, you know, artisty type. I'm like, oh, what am I? They're like, you're such a bro. You're so like, you're such a dude. Like, you love basketball games. Like, you really want to watch that? I'm like, yeah, I like sports. They're like, but like, actually, do you? Are you trying to fit in? I'm like, what are you talking about? I love competition. I love like watching greatness. Like, I love sports. I am very stubborn.
Lakers or Knicks?
Oh, Lakers.
Oh,
yeah, all day. I'm sorry. I know. I didn't get into sports until I was a little later. That sport. I was a Mets fan too, which is going to break your heart even more because you're Bronx.
Yeah. But, I grew up not far from Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. So I, you know, love, and I'm also like, I'm ready to be a dad like a million times over. I'm not a dad, but like, I'm going to be very organized and like, we're going to go to Disneyland and like, total typical father figure. Like, so, which doesn't line up with like, you know, oh, I thought you were going to be like Keith Richards and cool and fun and bohemian. I'm like, well, I play that part on stage and I love philosophy and I love poetry. And yeah, I'd like to think I am those things.
Yeah, but you could do all that plus be a dad.
Yeah, plus I'm not going to like do a bunch of heroin.
Mutually exclusive.
Yeah, this is like isn't this a bonus? Like, yeah. I'm sorry that I'm actually a functioning male. Like, I'm sorry. But so I'm starting to really accept that part of myself too. But
good, man.
That was your second to last question. What was your last question? I'm so curious.
Last question is, what's your definition of happiness?
Oh, I've stumbled upon it. So I grew up Christian. Okay. I grew up like, and the definition is the Lord and Savior Jesus. No, I'm kidding. Sorry. That's saying, no, this is going to be a good,
holy shit. I can't keep up with you, man. And I'm sorry. That's tough for me. I don't say that too many times. Holy shit.
Sorry. Oh God.
No, it's all good, man.
My friend Tommy, who I'm doing this record with, which we'll talk about, he's like, I've always thought I'd love to have your brain, Zane, but then I realized I'd only like it for one day.
Yeah, that's like a job, man. That's like, and it's always overtime, man. It's like being in there. Man.
But I've also learned to accept that because I have friends who speak quickly as I do, and I get excited about life. So I get, you know, I get manic sometimes, you know, but I don't experience myself as someone who is randomly, you know, just like I don't experience myself who has like an Asperger's-y
you have an awareness level.
Or like an ADD thing. It's just that my brain kind of works fast and I love just following it. Mm-hmm. But I always try to keep it logical and it makes sense. It's not just like random ideas, you know? So I started to appreciate that too. Like, all right, yeah, I do want to calm down a bit. I don't mind thinking the thoughts. I don't want to overwhelm conversations with the speed at which I kind of rush through things. So I'm learning that. But anyway, you asked,
you grew up Christian.
So I grew up Christian. Okay. Like in the church, like, Episcopalian church, which is sort of like Catholic light.
is hilarious, yeah, man.
It's liturgical. And then we have hymnal books and we have, you know, the bread and all that stuff, but we don't, you know, Episcopalians didn't believe that the bread is actually Jesus. That's a little different. We didn't pray to the mother.
Catholic light. I'm still stuck on that's hilarious.
My mom coined that term.
That's great.
And her dad was a priest in the Episcopalian church. And,
that's like people from England. That's a big,
exactly. So you can get divorced if you want. Hmm. We were the first like old school church to have a gay bishop. So it's like open-minded, but also like, you know, very liturgical. So I grew up in that. When I was 19, I became born again Christian. Hardcore. Like and because of the way my brain works and how I love facts and all that stuff.
Yeah, you can't do 50%.
I dove right into the Bible. And it's not that I become like dogmatic because I'm not really that way, but I love learning. So if I'm going to learn about something, I'm going to dive in. Mm-hmm. And I won't go around saying, oh, well, you should get into crystals or, oh, vaccines have mercury. I'm not like one of those people. I'm just like, I love learning and then we can have discussions based on facts that I've acquired, and I might be wrong and I'll change my point of view and who knows. So I got really interested in it, and it's more that I'm interested in things than it is that I like.
Well, you're curious, man. I understand.
Yeah. I'm just very curious. So I get into this Bible stuff and then I get really into Jesus and then I'm, And then I get really into going to churches, and I'm hanging with Johnny Lang and my brother, and we start going to this born again evangelical church. And then like I go through this 4-year phase of like born again Christian, like really hardcore. I never hated on people. I never judged people. But like friends would send non quote unquote believers to me who had questions, and I would answer their questions. Like, well, the Bible, you know, was actually written this way. You may think it was written that way, but it's actually written. There's 24,000 manuscripts that are 99.8% identical. And like, so it's actually more historical than you'd think. And I'd give all these facts, you know, and then I eventually kind of stopped going to church, and I came back into it via Hillsong. And then now I'm kind of in this space where I'm like, I'm finally finding a spirituality that feels so true and connected. And it's funny because most of my fear in church was like this sort of heresy factor. This like if you say something that we didn't say in the Bible, you're wrong, you know? And then what I discovered, because I'm so curious and interested in things, I learned past the evangelical stuff and went, oh no, they're only using some of the facts. They're saying, well, the Bible is God's inerrant word. It's like, but you guys, I found out recently that was never written in Christian writings until after the Enlightenment, which would suggest that it was a response to the Enlightenment, because once they found out that the earth was not the center of the universe, they had to fight back. But early Christians did not need the Bible to be inerrant.
They
inspired scripture. So I'm like, guys, if you want to be super quote unquote Christian-y, like you're kind of doing it very like in a response way, sort of like the Republicans are now. Oh, gays can't bake cakes for gays, and we can. It's like they're responding. They're not actually interested in truth. They're interested in responding because they want to hold on to their archaic idea. For me, if I find a scale on the guitar that is different, that gives me a new perspective, I'm going to go with that. New data I will always follow. So that's unfortunately what happened. So I had to drip away from the Christianity a bit, the evangelical thing. And so now I'm in this free-form land wondering what the truth is. I have Lyme disease. I'm terrified about life. And now I've finally come to find my own sort of spirituality, which is that here's my spirituality now, and it leads to my happiness. Whatever the truth is, my thoughts, my small thoughts of a person on a small planet in 300 billion galaxies, which each have 300 billion stars, therefore plenty of star systems that have planets around them. If I'm one of those people, I highly doubt my thoughts will change the truth, whatever it is. Now, I may change my perspective of the truth, but so my happiness now is I just rest in the fact that there is an ultimate truth, and it is what it is. And I will maybe never know it exactly as I want to, and I will maybe never categorize it or define it as I want to, but it doesn't change that it is there. So if someone says it's Islam, if someone says it's Christianity, it could be one of those two. There, it's very unlikely, oddwise, but it could be. Regardless, though, it is whatever it is, it is. It won't change by my definition of it. So I'm sort of like, I'm happy with that now. That makes me feel very rested. I don't have to figure it all out, is the point. So I like that. There you go. I don't know. I mean, that's
holy shit. I'm ready for like a week's vacation.
Yeah,
oh my God. And on top of all that, he's an amazing freaking guitar player. that's what the funny thing is here, man. Like, holy crap. You can all this is going on. Like,
yeah, well, when I'm playing guitar, these are the emotional and subconscious things that are happening. And so whenever I have a student, I always like to say, like, you know, it's amazing to know the notes, but a major 7 sharp 5 chord feels this way, and it may feel slightly differently to you, but it is these set of frequencies. And so if you really get to what that means, then when you play guitar, you're going to express that feeling, and that's more what it's about. But it is equal parts craft and nuance and feeling. But so these thoughts, you know, these are the reasons, and I will say this bluntly, and this will probably be a bad thing to say towards the end, but these are the reasons why I get challenged by the music industry, because I really believe that artists are teachers and healers and, you know, all this beautiful stuff. And I just feel like so many artists now are scared and making money and trying to find sponsors. And it's just, it's so devoid of what I think our purpose is. It would almost be like if athletes were all, if every athlete in every major sport was working really hard at, let me think of something funny that's different. God, I want to think of something really perfect here. At landscaping. They're all working on their landscaping. It's like, and they've lost their muscle mass because all they're doing is like some cutting trees. It's like, but you're, and they're like, well, we don't want to, the money's there. The money's there. And I was like, but you're so good at athletics. And like, you have a platform to share inspiring stories with people through your athletics. And they're like, well, I just want to landscape. It's like, why are you, it's like for artists right now, it's like, why are we all money grubbing? What are we doing? What are we doing? Like, oh, I'm successful. Oh, why are you successful? Well, I had a song in the top 10. That means you're successful. What the hell are you talking about? Mm-hmm. What are you talking? You are a cultural voice that is impacting children and adults alike. And you're giving them a crock of horse shit. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're an artist. So it really rubs me. And so I love is meeting people like Evan or like John or like, you know, people who really are writing songs that matter and that they care about the stuff. And sorry, I went on a tangent.
No, it's all good. I know I've got to wrap up, but I want to talk about the stuff you got going on. First of all, Zane Carney. If you never heard of Zane, check him out online. It's Zane, Z-A-N-E, Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y at ZaneCarney.com. So let's talk about some of the stuff you got going on. You got a summer tour opening up for on some dates and playing with Johnny Lang.
Yep. So we're doing a bunch. I think we're doing 25 dates of that. The dates I'm not opening, Buddy Guy is the dual headliner.
Wow.
Which awesome to just see him play and learn from him.
Wow.
Yeah. And maybe I'll weasel my way into sitting in on his set. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. But so that's going to be really fun. That's a lot of, Valley, what's it called? Virginia Falls. Falls Church in Virginia, which is near Washington, D.C. We're playing New York City. We're playing Albuquerque. We're playing Phoenix. We're playing a bunch of Midwestern cities, Minneapolis, all that stuff. So yeah, that'll be a really fun tour. And then I've booked my own solo tour dates between sort of on off days.
That's awesome. Okay. You also have a headlining show. You're headlining the Troubadour in LA.
Yes. So I had a residency in Los Angeles for 6 months at Hotel Cafe, which fits about 200 people or so. And every week I play different songs. I have about 80 songs I can draw from, maybe 100 actually, if you count all the jazz tunes. And I always do different versions of them each week. I have special guests each week who bring in their own songs. And so that was a sold out residency for 6 months at Hotel Cafe every week.
That's great.
So I'm thinking, how can I do another residency in LA without like kind of going back to that size venue? Because I want to keep growing and gaining new fans and all that. So what I'm doing now instead is a monthly residency at Troubadour. So one Monday every month, that's a 500 seat venue.
We're going to ask you that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's 500 seats. So there's plenty of room for everyone. And it starts July 30th in Los Angeles. And then we're going to do once a month, probably till the end of the year, and then see where we go from there.
That's awesome. And people can find out all this stuff on your website, right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay. You got the Zane Carney and Tommy King project.
Yeah. So Tommy King is my friend from high school. And then he went on to play with Maroon 5 for a little while. Started working with this incredible producer Ariel, who's done a lot of big things with Madonna and all these big acts. And then now is Haim's MD. He plays keyboards for them and is their MD. And he and I, we just love collaborating. He's truly one of the most gifted musicians in the world, one of the greatest piano players in the world. He and I play with the John DeVersa Big Band sometimes, which was Grammy nominated, you know, that's the thing.
Yep.
He's just a legend. And so we have this new project that we developed because we were trying to score films and TV shows and things, like, you know, all that. And we love doing it. And so we're like, you know what? Screw it. We're going to release this. Let's release this music that we've scored. The album's called Film. The album artwork was done by this incredibly above our pay grade, like brilliant friend, Lily Piper Fay. She's just an incredible fine artist in LA. And it's just a very art piece sort of record. And it comes out, I think, July 5th. It's up for pre-order on iTunes, and it'll come out July 27th everywhere.
That's awesome. It's Zane Carney, Tommy King.
And if you come to a tour date, before then, I'll have them for sale on CD as well.
Merch.
Yeah.
Awesome. You worked on stuff with Avril Lavigne.
Yeah. So when I got Lyme, I was like, what am I going to do with my life? Called my voice teacher. I'm like, yo, I just saw that Avril Lavigne's on TV talking about how she has Lyme. Who are her doctors? Because I'm screwed. She's like, I'll get you in touch. I'm like, okay, well, let her know I'm not trying to like get a gig. Like, I'm just trying to talk about Lyme. And so for 6 months, I would come over to her place. We'd watch movies. We'd eat sushi. She kind of took care of me in some ways because we were just friends. And then one day she's like, hey, remember that song you sang me, that original song of yours? I want to have faith again. I'm like, yeah. She's like, what if we wrote a song? I'm like, oh, yeah, I never thought about that. I'm that dense. Yeah, sure. And so we started writing. And so we've written like 4 songs, which is going on the next record.
When is that coming out?
Hopefully the end of this year, maybe early 2019. And we already have talks about me playing on her next tour.
That's awesome, man.
play guitar on the whole record almost, you know, so it'd be fun to do that.
That's awesome. That'll be Avril Lavigne. That's coming out next year, probably early 2019. Yeah. Yep. Your Instagram account is at Zane Carney. Mm-hmm. You're going to be in Tokyo.
Yeah, I'm playing. So I've been doing headlining shows in Tokyo ever since I played with John Mayer there. I had one off night with him in 2014. And I was like, oh, I want to play Tokyo. About 75 people showed up with 2 days notice. I was like, dang, these John Mayer fans are tight. This is awesome. And so the venue reached out to me and said, why don't you come back every 6 months? So I've been there 2 times already. And now the third time will be September 28th and 29th in Tokyo. I actually recorded a live album there and that came out on Spotify. Actually should be out by the time this releases.
And that's called Zane Carney Live in Tokyo.
Yeah. The bootlegs. Yeah. That's right. Like bootleg record. Yeah.
Domo arigato, bitches.
Yeah. Baby.
And then on the 31st, you got something going on with Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah,
October 31st.
I'm pretty sure this will be confirmed by the time this podcast comes out. If it isn't, it's all good, like whatever. But we created a new Instagram account called Evan and Zane. That's my band with Evan Rachel Wood, who's my dear, dear lover, friend. I just adore her. And truly
she's
one of the
dear, dear friend, not lover, right?
Sorry, I mean, well, soul lover. She's like my soul.
I just want to clarify.
Sorry, yeah. I mean, maybe
this is how rumors start.
Dude. Yeah,
I heard it on Garber's show. They're lovers.
It's in the realm of possibility because we do adore each other's hearts so deeply.
Awesome. Get rid of that damn Hiya app or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, exactly. But so
true love is right in front of you, Zane.
Exactly. But no, we're both going through transition, so we're supporting each other as friends now, but it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Go for it. So, you only have one life.
That's true. She's one of the people on this planet that makes me feel like I'm not alone because our brains work almost identically.
Oh, dude, let me tell you, time out.
Yeah.
That's a really good person.
I need to marry her probably.
Yeah. Or at least like, you know.
At least like hold hands. So we're going to play a venue in Los Angeles on October 31st. Mm-hmm. And every show Evan and Zane does is a themed show. So we did a Disney show, all obscure Disney tunes. We did a show for Valentine's Day that was all brokenhearted sort of love songs that were sad. We did a show recently at Hotel Cafe that was only names. Songs had to have a name in the title. And now we're doing for Pride Month, we're playing in Nashville right after Pride Month ends. We were going to do all the colors of the rainbow, but instead we're just going to do the color blue because so many amazing songs have the word blue in the title.
Tons.
And so what we're going to do is on October 31st, we're going to most likely be playing El Rey Theater. And it'll be a Halloween show. And it'll
That's
be the
awesome.
Most crazy Halloween set ever.
And it might be the start of your next romance. I'm just
now
saying.
Hey, baby.
And also, I was shocked. In between studying the solar system and Camus, Zane also gives lessons, both in person and Skype lessons. So you could, I mean, seriously, it is a rare opportunity to get to sit and play with a guy with this much experience and brain power. So if you're interested in that, go to his website at zanecarney.com. And I'm assuming there's like in a contact form or something that says, you know, fill this out here if you're interested in a lesson.
It's like you click on the merch button and you can buy a shirt of mine or album, whatever, signed album. And then it's like, oh, guitar lesson. And once you buy it, I get an email. And then within the next month, I'll find an hour and we'll make it happen.
Yeah. Awesome. And also you got a jazz thing coming out.
Yeah. So this John DeVersa big band I play with, that's the whole, you know, incredible big band. The trio of it is myself, Gene Coy, and Jerry Watts. Gene Coy on drums, Jerry Watts on bass. And it's just a special chemistry we have. And so I finally was like, screw it. Like I'm touring so much with Johnny Lang now and opening for him and selling all this merch on tour. I have a bunch of sort of liquid cash to pour into my own recordings.
Good for you, man.
So I bought a spool of tape, you know, 990 format, whatever. And we record straight to tape, fully improvised with Catrice Buckingham playing sax. And it's going to be an 8-song record. And I'm going to shop it around to some hardcore jazz labels.
Good, man.
If they don't bite on it, I'll just release it myself later this year.
You know what? I'm so dumb. I thought you were going to say, you said, you know, spool of tape. I thought you'd be like $9.99. I'm like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah, I know.
You're like $9.90. That's like way over my head. I don't know what that means,
format.
But it's.
It was like $9.91 apparently, format or something. I also could be saying it wrong. It might be $9.01. I don't freaking remember.
Or it might be like $9.99. Really, and that was the price you paid. Who the hell knows?
That is my favorite delay pedal.
There you go.
$9.99.
And also, you're headlining the Dario's tour.
So basically, we're doing a European headlining tour. I have a European booking agent. and we were looking for sponsors, and Diodario was interested in coming on board. So
that's my son's girlfriend, how she pronounces her last name.
Oh yeah, nice. Yeah. But so we're supposed to be doing I mean, and this isn't finalized yet, but from what I understand, yeah, they're going to be sponsoring this tour. So they'll be on all the branding for the posters, and we'll do like master classes in the cities before the show with like a special VIP ticket, and you'll get like Diodario strings as part of it. So yeah, that's the conversation right now. It should be finalized in the next month or so, and then we'll start promoting that tour.
That's a lot of fun. That's a pretty good value to get a master class with you, man. I know what the price is going to be. You told me. I thought it was a great value, actually. It's pretty nice.
Thanks, man. Yeah. So,
and really one more thing. But wait, there's more.
But wait.
Brazil.
Yeah, so this is – I've been trying to book Brazil for 4.5 years now, and this venue I'm hearing back from before this podcast releases, I'll be hearing back from people on the confirmation. So from what I understand, I'll be playing a venue called Jazz Nos Fundos in Brazil in December. We're going to pick the date. The Brazilian fans are the coolest, most amazing. When I played Rock in Rio with John Mayer, it just became immediate Brazilian fan base. They're my biggest fan base outside of New York and LA, like
that's
by far.
Fantastic, man.
And so why am I not playing there? I've been trying. The promoters keep bailing. Now we found one that's not bailing, and we're going to make it happen.
That's awesome. I actually have a lot of listeners in Brazil because I had interviewed Andreas Kieser from Sepultura.
Oh, man, you got to interview Matheus Sato.
Is he Brazilian?
Dude, Matheus. Oh, my gosh.
Well, let's do it.
Yeah, Matheus is Brazilian. He plays with Jesse J right now, and he was playing with Tori Kelly, and he's like the biggest Instagram guitar player. I think he has like 600,000 followers on Instagram.
I don't interview people unless they have a million followers, Zane. Sorry.
No, but like, he inspires a lot of young people, and I met him. He was going to MI, and he would come to my clinics, and then he would come to my jazz gigs. And then Tori Kelly called me because I worked with her on something back in the day. And she said, hey, I'm looking for a guitar player. Dory, my MD, was saying you might know someone. I'm like, oh, you have to call Matheus. He's the best guitar player. She's like, I think he might already be on our list. But I'm like, no, he's the best. If you don't hire him, I don't know what's going on. And then the next day, she's like, I hired Matheus. I was like, dude, did you put in a good word for me? I'm like, I didn't need to. You're the best. Why would I even have to?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that, man.
Oh, yeah, man. He's awesome.
Well, dude, I'm exhausted. This has been interesting to say the least, man. And I really wish you a lot of luck. I'm glad that you've done a lot. I'm glad that you've learned a lot and grown a lot. And I'd love to hear, you know, what the next chapter unfolds. And, you know, you'll have you back here in a couple of years when we've got Zane 2.0 or Zane 3.0 going on.
I'd love that, Craig. Man, what a fun interview. Thanks for creating a space for us guitar players to geek out.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Everybody, please check out Zane Carney. Go to his website, zanecarney.com. He's got a lot of cool things up and coming, regardless of whether you're here in the States, in Japan, in Brazil, in Europe, or even in LA. And that's it, man. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Awesome, Craig. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Zane Carney. Please check him out and support him. Say hello to him at his shows and tell him you heard him on this show and what an enjoyable interview it was. And thanks again for your time, Zane. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list and to get some special offers. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.